There's a Native American story that takes place during a season of hardship. A grandmother sat with her grandson, and she said to her grandson, "I feel as if there are two wolves fighting inside my heart. One wolf is vengeful, angry, fearful, sometimes violent. And the other is loving, patient, understanding, and kind." And the grandson asked his grandmother, "Which wolf will win, O grandmother? Which wolf will win?" And the grandmother replied, "The one I feed. The one I feed." So it gives us pause to ponder on, what are we feeding in our lives through habit? Are we feeding the vengeful habit patterns of greed, hatred, and delusion, fear, anger, outright words of hurtfulness or actions of hurtfulness? Or are we feeding, nurturing, fueling loving kindness, right effort, patience, tolerance, compassion, equanimity? These are the questions I think we all ask ourselves because we're here. We're looking deeply. We're trying to discover, what is it in my life that I can nurture that leads to happiness? What is it in our life that leads to more chaos? So a lot of our spiritual growth has to do with that. And of course, we don't just come to understand that when we sit quietly, but indeed in the middle of our daily lives, hopefully feeling that we're in the silent center, still part of the storm. As we learn more and more how to touch that place, we can bring that place into our daily lives so that we can know more clearly what's going on. So a big part of our growth and maturing in the spiritual way has to do with the willingness to face those places, to be more honest with ourselves, basically, and to know what habit patterns, what tendencies are we feeding. Questions were brought up in our small interactive group this morning about tendencies, patterns. What is the terrain of the mind and the heart? Which ones lead to more happiness, peacefulness in ourselves, which of course lead to more peace for others because we're able to have space to make choices? Or maybe sometimes the choice is made for us because the habit pattern has been established in goodness, in the leaning, the inclining towards, in a natural way, wholesome states of mind that can be acted upon. Which ones lead to more confusion, more anger? It takes a lot of humility. It takes a lot of honesty. It takes a lot of compassion to know that, to be there with those places where we're caught in the same cycles of unhappiness, chaos. So the metta practice that we will be doing during our weekend together, which will weave in with it some understanding of how to bring in a natural way sympathetic joy to our metta practice, equanimity, compassion, those qualities of mind and heart, which metta turns into depending on what we're facing. Hopefully this practice will give us skills to incline the mind there, to incline the heart there, because we see with a great deal of compassion that our hearts don't incline there always naturally. And it takes a habit pattern to be able to do that. It takes space to make the choice to maybe be quiet and not let it come out of our mouths, to, you know, hold back that tendency to slam the door and just be still for a moment and to watch what's going on inside of ourselves. What comprises this inner world? We're learning how to do that with our mindful awareness practice, to be able to be with difficult states of mind, to recognize more clearly and then with more confidence, what can we nourish and incline towards? What can we recognize and let go of, basically? So somewhere in all of our practice, most of us have had the thought or hope or idea that if we do any kind of metta on a consistent basis or loving kindness on a consistent basis, we'll just feel good all the time and we'll just be loving all the time. But actually that isn't so. Doing metta practice, just like the vipassana practice, requires us to be courageous enough to be with those difficult parts of ourselves. So I want to really frame that, the practice that we're going to be doing, in that way, so that we know, you know, to have hopes that it's going to be all lovey-dovey and we're always going to be there is just unrealistic. We'll hopefully, actually we can have realistic hopes that we'll be more loving towards those difficult parts of ourselves. And I think that's a realistic first step to take in our practice. We usually experience everything in our metta practice, just like in our vipassana or insight practice. We open to everything. So I just want to remind ourselves that when you came to the spiritual path, didn't you come with some intention to open your heart somehow, to open your mind somehow? When we look deeply, that's one of our intentions. And so when you made that intention or you made that hope, did you think that you were just going to control the mind to open to only what was great, wonderful to experience, easy? Yeah, I did. I thought, and then when it opened to everything else, I thought I was doing it all wrong. But it's not the case. When we come to spiritual practice and we say, I want my heart to open, I want to train the mind, which means opening the heart and mind, we have to be willing to open not only to the beauty, which I admit, you know, sometimes it's hard for us to be with even the beauty of our hearts, but we have to be willing also to open to what's difficult. So my hope is that we all be realistic about our practice. We're all have the willingness to open totally, totally to it all, because that's what the world is. It's all about everything. It's not all about what we want or what we think should be. It's all about everything. So the Buddha called metta practice a protective practice. As we go along during these 2 days, I'm going to drop in the teaching, the traditional teaching of Buddha, the Buddha about metta little by little. It's protective because it protects us from those states of mind that cause pain and suffering for ourselves and others. So we learn first, you know, we think that metta is one practice if we've been on a spiritual path a long time, and mindfulness is another practice, you know, the insight practice. Really, metta is a mindfulness practice. So put it in that category. During the time we're doing metta, we're mindful of metta. During the time we're doing vipassana, we're mindful of the four foundations of mindfulness. So in this practice, we're being mindful of loving kindness and inclining the mind there over and over again, so that it helps us to live more comfortably in what is called the Brahma Vihara, the divine abode. This divine abode, or we hear the word Brahma Viharas, those are the four divine abodes. These divine abodes are in our hearts. they're not someplace out there where we're going to reach some heaven realm or make the world all perfect, you know, so that everybody's on the right political side, what we think is right, or that, you know, there's no more wars, there's no more strife, there's no more chaos. It is like that. And how we can make it more peaceful is in our own hearts, how our relationship to it. And then hopefully our relationship to what goes on in the world creates such a strong, strong place for us to live from that we ourselves create ripples in the world that touch, connect people and make a difference for a better place to be. So these Brahma Viharas are the divine abiding places in our hearts. And they are, in the Buddhist teaching, metta, or loving kindness, that unconditional friendliness, which we call loving kindness. When that metta turns to suffering, the aspect of compassion comes out. So when metta is with suffering, it's compassion. It transforms to compassion, and that is the next divine abode. When that metta turns to joy in one's life, for joy that's going on in the world with an individual or a group of people, that metta turns to sympathetic joy or empathetic joy, altruistic joy. Sometimes you hear it in those terms. And that is the third of the Brahma Viharas. And when metta can open totally to accept all the ups and downs of life, the joys and the sorrows, and not to choose, not to pick, not to just be attached to, this is the way it should be and I want it to be and the world isn't that way and so I am in a terrible mess, you know. Then when we're not in that place and we're in a place of just open-hearted acceptance, this is equanimity. It's not accepting like being a doormat, that kind of equanimity, but it's accepting the way it is. Because the first step in being being part of the change in the world is just accepting how it is and then taking the steps. So these are the four divine abodes: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And during the course of our time together, I'll talk about each one of those. So we're learning how to incline our energy, our natural energy there more easily, is one way to put it. And we learn how to incline the mind there more within ourselves by first connecting with that part in ourselves. So by doing our metta practice, when we say our metta phrases or bring up a person that we're offering our metta to, ourselves or another person, we're learning how to not really connect with that person per se, but to connect with our ability to offer loving kindness to the person. So do you see where we shift our attention? It's not like we're sending loving kindness and our aim is to change that person so that person is peaceful and happy, totally protected, healthy and strong, live with ease of well-being. Of course, that's where we're inclining our wish for that person. But the true point of loving kindness meditation is to touch in with our actual capacity to do that. So it's a shift from affirmations. Do you all understand? Can you get that point? It's shifting to the place where that is coming from, our capacity to love, our capacity to not only to love, but to offer that love. So we're going to learn how to connect with that place, that capacity, that potential to offer our unconditional friendliness over and over and over again. The Buddha said, what a person reflects upon for a long time, to that her mind or his mind will incline. So here we have the opportunity to reflect on this particular thing, loving kindness, over and over and over again. It's so precious. It's so rare. Where usually in the world we don't go to a place where we say, now we're just going to reflect on this. Usually our minds are drawn here and there and scattered. But here we're bringing our attention over and over again to this place, to this very place, over and over again. It's quite scary to do that because we're not used to it. We end up more getting entangled, tied in knots in the web of pain, in the web of suffering, in the web of chaos. And we have to make a strong, courageous intention to go in the other direction. Because as Buddha and many masters said, that it's like we're swimming against the stream when we're on the spiritual path. And we have to keep a constant effort to do that. So I'm going to read something from the Dhammapada, which kind of points out what we're used to doing and hopefully points in another direction. If I can find it. Let's see. Here it is. He insulted me, she hit me, he beat me, she robbed me. For those who brood on this, hostility is not stilled. She insulted me, she hit me, he beat me, he robbed me. For those who don't brood on this, hostility is stilled. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone does hatred cease. This is the ancient and unending law. I think we can agree with that. Huh? This is universal. This is a universal truth. So we're going to do our best to incline the mind by that understanding. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone. We need more of that in this world to counteract what is happening in this world. As human beings, we supposedly have free will to choose how to respond to particular situations. But let's look honestly. Is that really what happens? Does free will mean that we just act upon our habit pattern? That we let our words just come out based on our habit patterns of, you know, when we don't like something, we say something in a way that maybe causes more confusion or strife or hurtfulness. Or when, you know, maybe we're not the kind of people who hit other people, but, you know, maybe we don't like what's going on and we stomp around or we, you know, we put something in the sink in a way where I want him to know that I'm not happy about this, you know. Okay? I'm there too. But then I see, I don't want to do that, you know. That's not free will. That's not, is that wise effort, wise will? I mean, it may be habitual pattern. So let's get clear here. What's habit pattern and what's really free will? Free will is when we have the clarity and the wisdom and the true compassion to make a choice. And we make that choice out of wisdom, compassion, into a habit. So that the habit patterns, our free will is based on goodness. It's based on clarity. It's based on wisdom. It's based on all those, you know, good things. And not on habit patterns that cause more and more hardship in the world. So if we don't have the training, our habits get more solid. If we don't have the training, we get locked in delusion, the delusion into thinking also that, you know, I do have free will. I just do what I want to do. What we want to do is not always what the best thing is for ourselves, for others. Delusion is usually accompanied by forms of aversion or attachment, and vice versa. In our metta practice, we will learn, you know, when we become aware of some aversive state of mind, which is the far enemy of metta, ill will, aversion, hatred is the far enemy of loving kindness. In loving kindness, one of the things we become mindful of is when it's there, and we bring loving kindness to that moment. But first of all, we bring mindfulness or awareness to that moment. When awareness is brought there, then delusion is dispelled. And that delusion being dispelled begins to dispel the aversion. So it doesn't, like attracts like. You know, unwholesome states of mind attract unwholesome states of mind. Wholesome states of mind attract wholesome states of mind. So when delusion is dispelled, the magnetic force of that to attract unwholesome states of mind, all forms of greed and hatred, begins to dissolve, begins to weaken. So the very mindfulness of it, the very dissolving of delusion itself, because there's a mindfulness of it, begins to weaken the forms of greed and hatred in the mind. So that's our training here. So I want to talk about choice now, just in an example, because it always helps to ground it in what actually happens rather than the theory about it. So I've been working on this for a long time, 30 years now, and it's still not easy all the time, but there's more in my heart, there's a more of a willingness to be consistent about it. So recently, last year actually, I was traveling, which, you know, that's my life. My grandson just asked me if I lived at the airport. Well, he picks me up there, but, you know, when I call, I'm usually calling from an airport somewhere, saying hello to my family. So I was at the airport in Bangkok, and my friend and I were just coming home from some practice in Burma, and we were in a line, and she was in another line. She was in a shorter line because she was in a first class line, and I was in the longer line. So I said, she said, "I've never been here. Where do we meet? You know, because I'll be done before you." And I said, "Meet me at this certain place." And I told her, and then I went to look for her in the place that I thought I had described, and she wasn't there. Now, she said, "I'll wait for you, and I'll try to get you into the first class lounge with me." And I said, "Great," you know, but I couldn't find her, and I looked all over for her, and what happened is I described a place that wasn't clear to her. So no big blame, but what happened for her was that she just waited there for over an hour, thinking that something happened to me, you know, and that she wanted to be there for me in case that, and depriving herself of being in a comfortable place because she was allowed to go to that particular lounge. I looked for her, and I didn't look in the place where she was. So my heart was beating fast, and I went to the place to board. Finally, she arrived. You know, probably an hour and a half passed by. She arrived. I could tell she was not happy. And she approached me, and I really understood, you know, but I was scared. and I was fearful of, you know, she's one of my best friends, and I didn't want to lose any connection we had. And so she approached annoyed, irritated, and I can say that that's true, you know, and even more on that side. And she said, "You told me," and I thought, "That's true." And I was feeling self-annoyance, self-blame, all of that. It was, the mind was just a muddle of trying to unravel it and figure it out and wanting to go into being defensive and explaining myself and all of that. And I could see the habit pattern so strongly, you know, like saying, "Don't get mad, you know, I didn't do it on purpose, and you know, it's like I did it on purpose and I didn't," and defending myself and all of that, and then also being upset that she was upset. And so I could see where the habit pattern was going, to do all that, to just go there and do all that. But you know, it really took a lot of effort to not go there. It took so much just to say and to have the intention to hold her upsetness and to be with it, to just be quiet, you know. So I had gotten some water and something to eat, some fruit, and to let her go through that and to say, would you like some water? You know, that's one of the first things I said. And she said, "No, I don't," you know, and she was crying. And it was a hard time, you know, being in the Bangkok airport. Asia is hard. So just to make the choice not to go there was really, really hard. But to have the habit pattern ingrained a little more of, yay, I did it. This is my effort towards free will that makes sense in the world and in my life. So that's free will to me, but the free will to choose what's beneficial. Do we have that? Do you have that? Do you have the will to choose what's beneficial? Or are you just flopped around by your habit patterns? It's a hard question to hear and to answer. And the harder it is to answer, you know, the more energy we need to have to be able to face it and to do something about it. And this is our practice here. You know, how can we go out shouting what should be done in the world when we don't do that in our hearts? So this is our training to be able to choose that, to over and over again to say, "I incline the mind towards loving kindness. May you be peaceful and happy," instead of saying, "You jerk, why are you thinking that?" You know, where the mind can go. But to say, okay, incline the mind towards equanimity right now, and to really be there with it. And when we're not there with it, to be honest that we're not there with it, and say, this energy is inclining the mind towards that place, even though it isn't there. It's inclining the mind there over and over again. So can that place be easily accessible? That's what we're headed for. So that place is connected to, in an easy way, the accessibility of it. It's at the forefront of the mind, not in the recesses of the mind and heart. So there was a strong intention to stay connected with my heart. There was a strong intention to stay in harmony and to constantly be aware of that and not say anything, but to constantly be aware of that. That's really hard to have, even when you have obscenity shouted at you, to just, you know, there might be a place where you say stop. But sometimes there's a place when you're just with the pain of that being in at that time. So choices. And like all of you, my own burning questions in life have been, what leads to disconnection? What leads to not really being in touch with that place in your heart? And which also leads to disconnection with others, disharmony with others. What happens? Do I know the terrain of my own mind? Do I know the terrain of my own heart? Can I be soberingly honest with myself? You know, and not just cover it up. So loving kindness is not covering it up with the honey of, you know, a mushy saying, phrase. It's really every time we say that phrase, it's like making the choice to incline here, making the choice to incline, connecting with my heart, connecting with harmony, or the possibility of harmony, even if we don't feel it at that moment. What leads to the end of suffering? So those are the questions we have, and little by little our practice answers them. So like all of you also, I didn't want to know this just from reading books or by hearing, you know, the beautiful Dharma tidbits and being able to whip them off when somebody says something about their life and we can respond with something really wise, you know, just in a few words or phrases. But actually to know that place in our hearts so that when it comes out of our mouth, it's from experience and not because we heard it in a book and we're just rattling it off, which is also good because, you know, we help ourselves, we help others. But knowing it from our hearts and not intellectualizing it, there's a big difference in between those two ways of being. Also, it's easy to hear a teaching and to, I've been in this place, and for me to sit there and say, that's true, that's true. It's easy to hear it and to accept it, and then that may last a little while. But to actually practice that in the world is a whole different story. So I revere the teachings that give the tools to really actualize that and not just to hear something said and then live with the beauty of that hearing for a while, that understanding for a while, and not know how to get there ourselves. That's not as good. It's still good, but it's not as good. There's a saying, Native American saying, gazing at the moon, I lose the pearl in my own hands. So it's looking at somebody else's wisdom, you know, oh, how often have I gone around saying, oh, this person is so great, that person has the greatest teachings, and I'm really, you know, gazing at the moon and losing connection with the pearl in my own heart. So through our practice on the cushion and in the world, we develop that kind of connection with the pearl in our own hearts, the accepting, loving awareness of what's going on within ourselves, and the true, powerful choice to incline the mind towards what we know leads to letting go, to relinquishing, to developing what is good to develop. So what makes it possible to open to all of what comprises the mind and body? What makes that possible? What nurtures that? It's not just mindful awareness or, you know, insightful awareness, but really, and really, it's unconditional love. It's the unconditional friendliness with all parts of ourselves. All parts of ourselves. The parts that are hard to be with. And some of us have a hard time accepting the good parts of ourselves. You know, for some of us that's an even greater task. more challenging task. So to be with all parts of ourselves with unconditional friendliness, which is metta, which is loving kindness. I like the word friendliness when we look in the Sanskrit for metta, or mitra, I think that's the word in Sanskrit. It's interesting that my husband long ago, it was another floating world I floated in for a while. His name was Mitra, and so I had the name Mitra for a long, long time, and that means loving kindness in Sanskrit. So the root of that word has a description, friend, or friendliness. So it gives us a sense of what metta really means. You know, how can we feel that in our bodies and in our hearts, not just as a theory, but it's like being a friend. And when you're a friend, when you're a true friend, isn't it that we open to whatever that person's going through? It's not always pleasant to do that, but we try to do that. And do we do that with ourselves? Can we be unconditionally friendly with ourselves? That's what we're learning how to do in our insight practice and in metta practice, because oneself is the first person, if we can go there in our metta practice. And the other word that describes metta is gentleness, or gentle. And so that's how we feel. When I was describing how it was with my girlfriend at the airport, wasn't always gentle. You know, it was like, oh, it was tense sometimes, and and I felt like, you know, saying shut up sometimes. About two times I felt like saying something like shut up, you know, but I didn't. I felt like, you know, that kind of energy, but that would be kind of hard to come out of my mouth, actually. But there were a lot of times when I just melted, you know, because of the strong choice, the strong intention to stay in harmony and to just say, it's painful for her right now, and I can be there with that pain. I can be friendly with her pain and be friendly with my pain too, not discarding my own pain, but be friendly with my own pain, be friendly with hers, be gentle. So there were times that I could feel that gentleness, you know, that melting, that sometimes in the text this gentleness is talked about as, in metta, as a gentle rain that falls on everything without discrimination. So this gentle rain is like the goodness of her heart. It's also, you know, the parts of her that are training like I am when it's not so gentle all the time. So this gentle rain can be with that too. Metta is also described as cooling. It's like sitting in the shade of a tree and noticing what's happening rather than sitting in a desert, you know, hot sun. It's like being in the cool. And when rain falls on something, it cools. Anger is like fire. Metta is like water. What do you think is stronger? What's more powerful? When water hits fire, what wins? Water is more powerful. Metta is much, much more powerful than anger. Are we used to making the choice to go there? You know, that's the big question. We know that to be true, maybe a little bit, maybe some of us a lot. But are we making the choice to go there? Are we developing it? So Metta is basically goodwill without any conditions. That unconditional goodwill. It means the offering of goodwill even though you're in a bad mood. Even though maybe I don't know you so well. That's a neutral kind of a person. It's goodwill even though maybe I have some attachment that I'll give you this goodwill and this love if you offer it back. You know, metta can turn into that too, or it can slide into some attachment. But it isn't that at all. It doesn't have any conditions to be returned. It's just a simple, outright offering. Along the way, we watch how the mind flip-flops and goes into some ill will or goes into some attachment. Attachment is the near enemy of metta. It's called the near enemy because it can seem like metta. Because sometimes it can feel good. You know, but, oh, I'm going to give this love and this person is going to love me back. Or I'm going to, out of love, I'm giving this person something and this person is going to thank me. You know, there's a big me in there. And so there's some attachment there. And do you know, it can feel good, right? Just to have the thought that a person is going to love you back or even appreciate you. But there's some attachment in that feeling good. That actual just complete offering without any attachment is much cleaner. It's not sticky. And the sense of joy that comes from that is far beyond the sense of joy of the thought or the possibility that someone's going to love you back or acknowledge you or anything like that. The sense of happiness and freedom and joy that comes from giving without expecting anything in return, giving your love, is much, much greater. So that's what makes it a true friend, unconditional. We offer our love, our affection, our goodwill, even if it doesn't come true. So when we give these wishes, we're not even having attachment to that, may you be happy. You know, like sometimes I've said in Dhamma talks that I'll say to my children, it's not like, may you be happy and I offer you this blessing, this wish for your life. It has a little bit of stickiness to like, may you please be happy. You know? And so it's not like that at all. It's not like you're even wanting it to come true. Nothing. There's no attachment to the outcome of your offering, of your blessing. So we have to say something for many of us. If we have to base that blessing on something in this relative world. You know, we have to use words, relative words, thoughts. But for some of us, it may be just a matter of offering the blessing. You know, offering the loving kindness without any words at all. So I'll give you some options when that time comes this afternoon. This is a poem that he gave me permission to read this. His name is Frank. He did a loving kindness retreat. And this is the way he experienced it. Came down to very simple basics. When you look at a flower, when you love it, you don't ask for anything in return, do you? You just love it. And it's good. It's just that simple. Life is just that simple. So this is the most down-to-earth understanding of loving kindness that I've come across. So we're not expecting some kind of high or celebratory enthusiasm with loving kindness, or, you know, like we're just going to start feeling like we're floating. And it's really quite grounded, a sense of groundedness. There's a lot of equanimity. Without equanimity, loving kindness could not be true loving kindness, because what does equanimity allow? That's woven into loving kindness. It's the acceptance of the conditions. You're offering loving kindness to this person or group, however that person or group is, that's the condition of their life right now. Whatever the condition of your life, I offer you this loving kindness. So there has to be a big, spacious heart and mind to be able to do that. So not to expect anything high. There's a feeling of deep acceptance, a feeling of deep patience. There's a lot of spaciousness in the mind. When metta, loving kindness, maybe you pick a person and that person is ill in body or in mind, emotionally or whatever, you might feel compassion. And so that's part of it. Temporarily, your loving kindness has turned into this feeling of compassion for that person and being able to hold their predicament, their situation, without just giving the blessing, giving your energy. It's like, okay, I'm holding this moment with you. I'm not trying to make a change. I'm not trying to fix it. I'm not trying to say it shouldn't be that way. It's just I'm holding this moment with you with loving kindness. So, the purpose of my teaching of the holy life, said Lord Buddha, of the Dharma, is not for gaining merit, nor for good deeds, nor to gain rapture, nor concentration, nor insight, but for the sure heart's release. This and this alone is the reason for the teaching of the Buddha. So in the case of metta, it's the heart's release from ill will and from attachment. And along the way, some delusion is released because there is an opening to what is. And we understand very deeply that hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone. This is the ancient and unending law. So we know that the near enemy is attachment, because it can seem like, it can feel for a while like, can feel good, and we mistake it for loving kindness, or we don't see that there's some attachment in our offering of love. And the far enemy is ill will, and all the various modes of ill will, like impatience, frustration, even guilt. Guilt is ill will towards oneself, and even depression can be part of that. There's hatred, there's rage, you know, all the very gross forms, gross meaning very heavy, thick, feel it so much. When I was in Burma, just this last time practicing, Steve came, my partner. I think a lot of you know Steve Armstrong. He arrived when I was about midway into my practice. And there, you know, of course it's silent, but when you have a visitor, you talk, and then you just learn how to be with it. And so he came and visited me, and we talked for about an hour, and he told me how things were going at home. And he told me that our cat was dying, and that she hadn't eaten for about a week already. And that, so she's a cat that's been with us for a long time, about 20 years or so. And of course, it really struck me, you know, my heart was really open, vulnerable, but strong in its vulnerability, clear, more clear than usual because I'd been practicing. And so I made a determination to send metta to her at certain periods of the day. And that made me more aware of what was going on in my heart. So I saw how much attachment there was to her. You know, when I said, may you be healthy and strong, it was like I wanted her to live. But maybe that wasn't her path, you know? And when I said, may you be peaceful and happy, if she was indeed dying or even not dying, you know, I wanted it so much that I could see that love, that just simple, open-hearted offering was kind of squeezing my heart a little bit. And I was grateful to be able to see, you know, how it slides into that attachment. And it's where equanimity comes into play. So I wanted to be able to introduce to you right off the bat an equanimity practice that we can bring into our metta or loving kindness practice, because it really helps me all the time. It's when we offer our love to any being, and which I did for our cat Feather, and when we say, may you be peaceful and happy or safe and protected, but we also have the understanding or even put the words into there, some equanimity words connected with our metta words that say, and things are just as they are. This moment is just as it is. You know, so it has a feeling of release, of attachment. Not necessarily, it releases that person too, to their own karma. But really it begins to release our attachment to how we think it should be. Because attachment can be tricky in metta, because we think it should be a certain way for that person, or those persons, or this society, you know, should be all, you know, all of us should be Democrats, or all of us should be Republicans, or whatever, wherever we're at, you know, with that, or it shouldn't be this way or that way. Can we send metta to George Bush or to Cheney or to whoever is making those decisions about Iraq? Maybe some of us are for the war, I don't know, but whatever it is, can we send metta to that person without any reservation and not say, I'm sending metta to you so you'll change your mind, so you'll become more loving and happy, and you won't do these things anymore, you know. So it's without reservation. So when I sent metta to Feather over and over again, I became more acquainted with what goes on in my heart. What does attachment feel like? You know, what does that tightening up feel like? So you will become aware of that, more and more aware. And when you need to, later I'll remind you, when you need to, weave in an equanimity understanding. This is how it is right now. You know, your life, our life, my life. I offer you this loving kindness, and it is as it is right now. Not forever, but right now it's like it is. So that's a very big part of metta that I find that when I bring that up right off the bat, it helps us to really understand what true metta is and to do it in a way where our minds are open and spacious. So I'd like to end with this beautiful grouping of words from Sri Nisargadatta. All you really need is already within you. Only you must approach yourself with reverence and love. Self-hatred and self-distrust are grievous errors. your constant flight from pain in search for pleasure is a sign of love you bear for yourself. All I plead with you is this: make love of yourself, make love perfect. Deny yourself nothing, give yourself infinity and eternity, and discover that you do not need them, for you are beyond. So may that open your heart beyond your perceived limitations, and let's sit and be quiet for a moment.